media, basically, and not so specific to radio, but the idea of dealing with small communities and just news gathering and dissemination issues that we've discovered. As I mentioned, I come out of running small newspapers. I ran a regional paper for a while for the Catskills that dealt with five different counties. More recently, I've been running, in addition to writing for a group of town newspapers, I've been editing two hyper-local newspapers that are going to be publishing their last issue, you know, 2 weeks. It's we were supported by, we came about because of a large development issue, and a local resident with money kind of asked me to come in and start a paper for seven issues, and 9 years later he's finally running out of steam, and we were never able to build it to the point where it could grow beyond. He grew tired of, or his wife grew tired of their money.
So it was a Gitter response.
Had no idea that's how the paper started. That's really interesting.
And Lisa?
Well, my own experience, my first job in radio was at KTPR in Fort Dodge, Iowa, and it's an area of the country with one of the lowest population densities. I was covering 20 counties. I took the job sight unseen. It was during the last, 1990-91 recession that affected young people coming out of college. And I just wanted to work in radio, and I was literally willing to go anywhere, and I did. And but it was such a great opportunity for me because, first of all, this whole idea of strategizing to cover rural areas, I had had very little training in journalism, so I just worked in this very innate way. I've got 20 counties, they have their daily little crime, this, that, thing, but I have to figure out how to very selectively do issues-oriented coverage. And this was in the early 90s. It was before online, viable online journalism, certainly in the local way. And it was before, cell phones and a lot of other stuff. So I worked through that the best I could. And then later in my career, I worked at a bunch of different radio stations. And then later in my career, I ended up here at WAMC, which is the public radio station that covers parts of seven states. And I was the Hudson Valley reporter. And so I had to do something very similar with the 6 to 8, depending on the day, county area, where I was doing issue-oriented coverage. So Paul and I, and I'm now a journalism professor and very interested in what's happening in the online world, multimedia. I've ended up doing a lot of print as well, some of it regional. I used to file stories for the it's now a closed section, but it was called the Westchester section of the New York Times, where it was the section you'd get in your newspaper, I don't know if you got it all the way up in Hudson, but most of the Hudson Valley would get that section, even though it was mainly Westchester County. So again, issue-oriented coverage, I would say, of, in this case, suburban, but rural or semi-rural areas. I wouldn't have thought of it as my specialty or one of my specialties until Paul called me, but it's true that for a large part of my career, I've been trying to figure that out. So what I see happening with just being friends with Paul and his involvement with the community radio station that's getting started here is all these new possibilities in online journalism, because you can have your terrestrial radio going on, but then you can use audio to bring to have sections of your online presence that are very local. So you can go to a town meeting in Catskill that maybe somebody in Great Barrington isn't that interested in. I'm referring to places in our coverage area, but broadcast some of that on the air, but then pop the whole meeting up online in sort of a hyper-local section. And I think that's incredibly exciting. So I'm sort of rambling on, but that's where I'm coming from. And
yeah, one of the things we're finding is just that the I mean, because we've had an online presence at GXC for over, almost 2 years now, and it's a, now that my papers are sliding away, I'm going to be able to put more concentration onto the news blog. One of the first things I want to do is to, we've been utilizing it a lot to publicize our own going on the air, which I want to weed out. It's a danger that, I know in my newspapers, my publisher's always pushing for us to be self-congratulatory and put stories in about what we're doing, and it's something that I want to pull out as much as possible.
So meaning using the online site to promote the radio?
Yeah, or you know, where you put the different events on. And it's, I think you have to, one of the things that I'm going to take a step back, one of the things I'm finding, I'm in this period right now where we announced, we were coming out every other week, and which is a nice news cycle. It matched the development of news in our area and didn't overstress it. A lot of these, like the towns we're dealing with here, Hudson and Catskill across the river have daily newspapers, but there's not enough news to maintain a daily newspaper.
So and they don't find enough news.
And so they do a mix of AP stories and goofy life stories that they pull off of, wherever, and a lot of TV guide material, and it becomes a crappy paper because it's...
It's all the local content, really.
Yeah.
And they don't... They don't have staffs anymore. These papers are running very thin resources. They'll have, the Freeman has, three or four full-time reporters. I don't know what it is up here, but it's really...
I think
really
the Times Union's even down to, three or four.
Oh, no, they must have more than that.
No, I mean, not in terms of online. They have a lot of editors in there, and they're working more with correspondents and stuff.
Okay. Well, that would be scary. They're putting out papers with very small local staff. So, anyway.
What I found in the last, since we announced that we were going to be doing one more issue last time, we've gotten dozens of letters in of people finally saying what they appreciate. You never hear anything for years and years. And the way I had set up my paper in the first part was kind of simply from having been doing it for decades, but also just sense of the resources I had. I was able to pull a lot of people that I've been working with into the process and set up a front section that is five news stories, each issue on the front. One of them town board, one a more regional story, a school board story, something that is featurey or issues oriented that reflects something going on a larger basis, and then a feature story of some sort. And then there's usually a planning issue or something like that also bumps on. We then have a whole section of kind of blog news where I'll pull from what's going on in the dailies, from all sorts of different things, and mix it in together so it reads straight through. And I'll throw in national stories that I feel have a local pertinence or aren't being picked up by people enough. I'll do a lot of...
Are you pulling those from wire copy, or are you rewriting them through?
I'm rewriting them from wherever and just into the format. And it's never been a problem. We're kind of under the radar to a certain extent, and we give it a much kind of livelier air. I tend to do that all myself in one large lump. We do all our photos are standalone photos with captions so that they're not illustrative. It gives me more room to get a sense of coverage, and then the whole back of the paper are columns that haven't changed, and a few of them have changed over time. I always have a kid writer. As soon as they turn 16, they're out the door. It's like Menudo or something. But it's a, because their voice shifts, and then I put them into the front somewhere and let them write from the teen voice, which is a different sort of voice than the kid's voice. I have, you know, a senior writing. I've got a you know, woman from an agricultural perspective. I have a kind of an avant-garde poet doing a fake gossip column. Turns out all these letters have been coming in the last few weeks, and everybody appreciated every little element of the paper, particularly the letters column, which I would pull from other papers when we started to lag, but we usually have 5 or 6 pages of letters, and they're all over the place. And one of the things I've always enjoyed is editing them so that they have a flow that one letter will counter another, and they'll have some humor in it, and it'll reflect a broad, lively sense of community. The thing that really surprised me was the number of people who really appreciated the advertising. And it's something that we, and it reflects a battle, or not a battle, but a discussion, ongoing discussion we're having as we're setting up this community radio station, is where do you go in terms of underwriting? How far do you go, et cetera? And the thing that these small communities really need is a place that they don't have any other way of getting word out about their businesses. And a lot of the communities are based as much on the activists within the community and the schools and all of that, are these businesses struggling to survive. And also people moving into the community who want to know, you know, where do you get your firewood? Who do you go to for gardening? Who do you, what are the sales at the local restaurants? And once people start advertising, that's a way of, you know, they see that as just as vital. I mean, I always saw it as just these blocks that you put around to make unavoidable blocks. And
now, businesses are in the community in a lot of cases. And
yeah.
It's a small town.
Hi.
May I join?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Come right on in. Yeah, so it led me to preparing for this and to realizing that one of the things with any form of community media that you're serving different, very different functions within that community that have to be balanced in some fashion. And the idea being that, you know, there's the news, that both the news from within that community, you know, I mean, town board meetings and school board meetings and, you know, fire elections and all those things need some sort of coverage, or they just happen in a vacuum. You know, in a city, you don't see a lot of that stuff. It doesn't get covered anywhere. But in a small town or in a county, that it's really quite important. And it doesn't matter always whether it gets reflected in the publication or on the broadcast. What's more important is that
just physically being there is very important.
Yeah, but even that you don't have to do these days because of public access and other. It's just knowing if you cover it enough times or do mentions, you can let them know that you're covering.
Yeah.
And people will also know that they can you know, there's a place they can go to find out what happened, even if it's not, if it doesn't always make its way in to the paper. At the same time, you know, you need to bring in those news stories from outside on a state basis or a regional or a national basis that have an effect on your local population. You know, there are things going on in agricultural bills that you just don't pick up elsewhere, or trade bills, or you know, there's a whole lot of sustainability and smart growth initiatives that are coming through our state government and coming down through the federal government, and I've been picking up on those, oddly enough, from the Tea Party sorts who bring it up to me. But I spent a lot of time. I covered the Tea Party from its inception in our area all the way through, and was able to get a standing ovation from them for being fair, for letting them have their say. I wasn't afraid of what they were saying, realizing once they said it, everybody recognized, oh, that's the same property rights stuff they were talking about 20 years ago. So there's the news thing. There's also the what you need to remind people of what their community is. And there are a lot of people that move into a community during Why You're Up who have no idea what that community is. And people who are within the community who watch or watching Fox all the time or whatever, and they forget what their community is. And so those are your, you know, everything from your AA meetings to your pictures of kids doing things at parades, all of that sort of stuff. And then your cultural attributes, which are which would die often without the help of the media. And all those three things kind of build a community.
In our community, you have to constantly have historical context for newcomers, so they don't have a clue about the history and mm-hmm. the background of how everything works.
And where are you from?
From Taos, New Mexico.
Okay. Yeah, so you have that phenomenon.
Explaining what an Esequia is, what a land grant is.
Yeah, and it's a similar thing maybe with that kind of community the way it is here, where people come into these communities of the Hudson Valley, often from New York City, sometimes from elsewhere, with utopian ideals, quite frankly. You probably had that in Taos. And the reality hits them really fast, that there are problems here, that if you want to be a part, you know, that there are options for participation in a way they may not have seen when they were in New York City or wherever.
But they have to get educated. Yeah.
But they have to be aware and get it, absolutely. So. You know, one thing to bring what Paul was saying back into the medium of radio, one thing that I find is super important, I mean, I started in community radio, as I mentioned, and did I mention in Minneapolis? I worked for a very well-established, feisty community radio station. That's where I learned to be a reporter. And I think one of the really important things to think about as you're shaping a station or developing a station is quite frankly I hope this doesn't offend anyone who may be involved in this, but the public access phenomenon, which let's just speak in a really real way. Public access stations, if they become too insular, too hyper-local as they're moving through the program clock, are going to be tuneaways, and similarly with community radio stations. So I think that there has to be some sense of engaging the listener and really thinking about the whole coverage area. You need to give them an experience that they can connect with, as opposed to just showing stuff, you know, like, okay, we've got the camera to the meeting, we've got the tape recorder to the protest. In the end, you know, some people are going to be interested, but when you think about today's world, I mean, when public access started, there was no online journalism. And people were, if they wanted to watch that town meeting, they knew exactly when they could do it. They usually repeated it. I think Channel 23 will often mm-hmm. repeat things throughout. But when you think about it now, there's so much more competing for people's attention. And that you can use your online component to slap up those meetings. People can listen to them anytime. But don't think that's going to make great radio today. I'm just going to be completely frank about it. It's not.
3 hours of a board meeting.
Exactly. People are not. They need narrative and they need story. And they also need. You know, I think too, it's really important when community stations are trying to build community and track listenership. There are other forms. I mean, you don't have to go and do like a highly produced sound documentary. That's, of course, a wonderful thing to do every so often if you have the resources and the expertise. But you can use the aliveness of radio to create narrative and story and engaging content. So if you can, you know, with your volunteers or with your staffs, cultivate some talent. Like, who's the person who has a gift for gab, has a spirit of curiosity, can keep an interview going, can deal with call-in shows, you know, things like that. That is somebody who could very well be the person who has the, you know, and this is very low cost. You're just talking about one or two people, you know, in terms of production costs and things like that. They're sitting in a studio to get it set up for call-in. And then people get excited because they can really participate. And you can, and if your talent is good enough, and again, these people don't have to be like, you know, Rachel Maddow or someone like that. But if you have somebody who's engaging enough and spirited enough, that people will get excited about that as an event they can tune into without leaving their own homes, which, you know, I'm not saying people should leave their homes more, but the reality of it is that, you know, we have kids to raise, we have juggling multiple obligations, and radio can reach out and feel and be participatory in that way. So I think that, you know, that's a very serious thing to think about if you want committed underwriters and supporters, a committed listenership, is giving people an experience as opposed to just getting out and, you know,
part of our
doing
our
a live feed
to,
into this or that, yeah.
Is to have, I mean, our listening area will stretch almost 150 miles, you know, and there's all these small villages. So our plan is to try to get equipment and internet connection so that we can have each community bring their reports from that community, so that one, it'll be really what's happening, because there's no way that we can know in all those little communities what's happening. We won't have the resources to go out there. But more importantly, they'll take ownership of that. They'll bring in listeners from their community.
Yep. iPhones do it, are just in open line on an iPhone. You can web stream or, you know, and archive immediately, which we've done a lot of. We've done 7 Meet the Candidates events on the same evening, you know, where, you know, just all gets set up into a different stream on the web, and it all gets archived, so then everybody in those towns can then re-access that.
Yeah, well, in our community, I don't think the internet, I mean, there's a certain portion of the community that definitely is tuned into that, but a lot of people will still only be tuning into the radio. So we, you know, I think you have to have both.
Yeah, yeah, this
a radio
is, this
component
is,
and you have to have the internet component.
So let me ask you, what do you think? So you have, I think it's great that you have these community people who are wanting to connect.
We're still identifying them, and it's going to take some building. You know,
yeah, but that's exactly the strategy. Get people who are already there. I used to, when I was in Iowa, I would, these people weren't reporting for me, but they were tipping me,
yeah.
You know, and letting me know what was going on, because I always had to do very issue-oriented coverage if I was going to do a feature on, you know, what was going on in the area. And so I think this could be a very rich experience. And what do you have in mind for them? Would they be reporting?
What we really want to do is give them a whole block of time. In other words, like the community of Abiquiú has a community library. So there's already kind of like a structure of people going there. And if they had recording equipment and they said, we're going to give you 2 hours once a week for whatever you want to put on there, and part of it would be reporting the news, but it might be, you know, music that they've recorded or just what their community wants to hear, you know. So our hope is that, you know, like in Mora is 100 miles from Abiquiú. People in Abiquiú have no clue what's happening in Mora. But a lot of the issues are actually the same. In other words, if right now there's a fracking issue in Mora, you know, that they're fighting, but they don't, how do they connect with Abiquiú? If there was, every week there was a report from Mora and Abiquiú, both communities would know what was happening and they could actually network and support each other. Because what happens in our rural state is everything happens in Santa Fe. And the state press reports it from the Santa Fe point of view. They don't report what's happening in Mora. And so Santa Fe gives out crumbs of patronage for everyone to go along with what Santa Fe wants to do, but they don't. The North doesn't organize and say, no, we're not going to do that. And I think if people were informed, there would at least be the chance that all these rural communities, which are basically facing the same kind of issues, but never make coalitions to stop these things, then maybe some things would develop. You know, so.
And that's where you might also need a, you would probably also need a what I would call like a front page contextual.
Yeah, we'll have a news report. In other words, we'll have some kind of daily news report about the whole northern New Mexico, which will pick up this. But having that community report in the way that they would say it is also really important, I think. You know, it's like whenever, that's part of the problem with the statewide press, is it's always reinterpreted. It's always through somebody else's voice. And they usually misinterpret it, basically. So having them being able to tell their own story responsibly, I mean, it's obviously in each community, at least in our areas, there's lots of factionalism between the communities. So you have to figure out who can be a little bit fair in reporting it. But just the fact that there's someone from that community's report, it's just like free speech radio news, where when you hear a report from Nigeria, it's a Nigerian saying instead of a BBC reporter. It really makes it more believable, to me anyway, that you have that.
Here's an odd thing I found in terms of, you know, one of the towns I'm dealing with, it's been very difficult. I've thrown reporters in from the outside, which and they bounce out.
Where is this?
Olive.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Olive is just a very contentious place.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, I've worked with you know, activists who overwork the piece or just can't keep themselves out of it. And finally, I found that if I'm working with this woman who was the Republican conservative candidate, her husband like started the Tea Party, and she's actually turned out to be a great reporter, and it managed to completely quiet down all the complaints, and everything started working together, because she suddenly realized that she was more effective
being
a reporter without inserting herself. And I was, you know, I didn't hard edit her, but I pulled out, you know, the conjecture parts and stuff, and she gradually learned that, and it worked really well, and she's become very, you know, it's done this healing process for the community as a result. You know, similarly, I found that this other woman who does just a gossip column, I can't even read the thing, but it just has this huge effect in town where she's been around forever, and I put it on the front page, and if everything that filters through it, you know, just creates.
Well, we found definitely that if you do report from all points of view, and you do let the Republicans come on as well as your credibility just goes up so much,
yeah.
And people are so much more willing to talk to you when they see that you're going to present more than one point of view. And it takes work, as you know, you have to really develop those relationships. Yeah.
It also takes a lot. We're still in the process of wrestling through a lot of that in terms of our policy writing for the station, and it's difficult writing policy where you're trying to assure an even-handedness while keeping out, you know, our fears of hate speech and when it gets crazy. And it's what we're finding is that it's better to always err on the side of openness,
right,
as much as possible.
What training do you do for reporters? I mean, when you start up?
What are you guys doing at the radio station?
Here, there's a whole, you know, people come through and do technical training. We have a whole kind of policy handbook thing that we've put together, but it's a lot of it just comes from, a lot of it's been finding people that mix well together, that can work well together. You know, one of the people that I'm pulling in right now is has been on village board and town board and county legislator, and he's a relationships therapist, and he brings this unique perspective to everything he does, where it's very balanced. Plus, he's got an Irish background, so he can go into brogue really easily. You know, he's serving to counter. You know, we also have somebody who's very cantankerous, who we're all a little worried about, but the two balance each other perfectly. So it's always trying to come up with a balance. At the newspapers, I've just tended to find somebody and throw them in, and I can usually tell.
You can edit them in. Yeah.
Or I can just tell from their voice whether they're going to work or not. And if it doesn't work, that's fine too. It's no big problem. I can edit it into shape for that one time, and they'll know right away whether they're not working or not. You know, in a newspaper, I look at it as just a, I mean, What you're dealing with is basically creating a community of voices try to reflect the community, you know, that you're servicing at the same time. So it's that mix of, and that comes down to the music too. I mean, when we got all our, you'll see when we do our programming announcement tomorrow, that I think it's turned into a pretty good mix. And it was difficult at first because, like, in our music offerings, everybody was kind of grouping towards the alternative rock sort of area, and it was really hard to kind of make sure that we had a country aspect, that we had, you know, that we reflected a number of different areas, and yet have everybody not be too niche-oriented that people just turn us off at certain times.
I want to say that when you develop your stations, that it as you're dealing with this issue of community inclusiveness, it's also okay to have a vision. For example, in dealing with these alternative radio folks, I think it's really important to step back and say, why the hell are we on the air? You know, anybody can listen to alternative rock at any point on Pandora, on, you know, the many of the rock stations in the area, on iTunes, what have you. But what are you offering that's new and vital to the table? That kind of thing. So, it sounds like you've passed through that issue. And it's not just about, in the end, you know, diversity, inclusiveness are really key to what community radio are. But it's also okay to draw your lines, you know, and say, all right, we need to be offering something, whatever your vision is. That we need to be offering some, you know, unique musical offerings that people would in no way have exposure to anywhere else. That would be one vision. It doesn't have to be everybody's. What's your raison d'etre, I guess? And a similar thing for news coverage. I think you want to be thinking about that a lot. Because there's sort of a, you know, I think that we've all learned that diversity is a wonderful word, but it's also a slippery slope. In terms of who's going to fight to get on your airwaves. You know, you want to cover hate speech, but you don't want somebody snatching up an hour of programming time who's going to be speaking hatefully just in the name of diversity.
Yeah.
You know, so that, I mean, that's obviously an extreme example. But anyway, you were talking about, how do you train people? I wanted to address that. I think that what you'll find is, your station will probably attract a number of different types of people. There'll be the people who are just really happy to be out there involved. They've got maybe an issue they want to bring to the table, or a few of them, and they want to be out there, you know, getting sound from meetings, doing the kind of iPhone, you know, low-tech stuff. And then there are going to be people who will care aesthetically about radio as an art form. And I think that there are places for both, absolutely. And I think that for people who are caring aesthetically about radio, especially radio journalism as an art form, that there are a number of really, really good resources that they can use and that I use in teaching, but anybody motivated can just look up. They don't need to come to a class. They can just
look
up. You
just point them to it.
Yeah. I would say really, really good resources are transom.org. Do you guys know about Transom? Yeah. Transom's great. And the people who do Transom are... you can call them on the phone. They'll be happy to hear from you. You know, there's great energy with that. And I think that with software, we live in this wonderful time where you can get a lot of information on how to produce radio just by going online. I imagine a lot of you use Audacity as a radio production tool. That's a really great low-tech, you know, sort of entry-level audio mixing program that's free, and you can teach yourself this program very quickly. And in teaching yourself it, know the fundamentals of multi-track mixing and digital editing and all that you can bring to other higher-end programs if you choose to go in that direction. And then I would suggest doing things like, I know concurrent with this presentation, Karen Michelle, who's a fantastic radio producer, is giving a talk on, you know, radio aesthetics and things like that. I think you want to be getting yourself out to situations where you can train and learn as much as possible. Does the NFCB still exist?
Yeah.
So I've been a little out of the community radio loop, but
You know, they used to have big trainings, conferences, you know, even doing things like having one of your, you know, having somebody you know is going to commit to the station in the future go do an internship at the station, and I'm assuming there's one in Santa Fe, a public radio station, you know, do an internship and take those skills. No, there's not.
There is, but I don't think they're offering.
Well, so say there's a college student from your community who's really into it. You know, they go away to college somewhere. Having them do either through classes or through internships, do training on, you know, radio journalism, and then bringing those things back to your community. I think all those things can be really useful because you are going to attract people who see this in as a big part of their future, as a potential professional training ground. You know, just the way that I did when I was into.
Well, Association of Independents and Radio also is a good resource.
Yeah, AIR. Thank you. I knew there was something else I was leaving out. AIR is great. They have forums. They have conferences. They're mentoring programs that are wonderful and free, where you can say, I'm just starting out and I want to do this. And those are really, really good resources.
We set up the community college here, and we're also setting up with the different high schools and setting up programs.
That's great.
And then working with we were trying to work with the local newspapers, and unfortunately, they're kind of boycotting any news of us right now.
And that's really common. I used to pitch radio stories to the New York Times all the time.
It's a very competitive market, and
everyone's
just totally insecure about their, you know, place in the market.
Yeah.
We have a pretty good cooperation relationship with our newspaper, but at any point we feel like they'll just change their mind and stop covering us because we are competition.
Can you just go back to the program with the community college? Could you be a little more specific?
Yeah, we're doing helped them set up a broadcast studio over there, and through Dharma and some of the other people who come through, and we're hosting people coming through and teaching regular class over there on you know, radio broadcast.
Ours is different because we have a college and a big community college, but they already have their own stations, but we've pulled some people who've gotten their experience there to help us younger people and techies to do ours, but we were trying to get the kids to help us with actually starting the station, though. You know, maybe it could become a class project or something. That's what I'm trying to work on.
That would be, we're working with Bard is setting up a station simultaneously.
Oh, they are?
That, but it's not for the college, it's more for broadcasting some of their academic assets and new institute programming out. And so they're working with interns and students doing a lot of the technical stuff, but working with the faculty in terms of doing the actual programming.
Is it low power?
So, and it's the same power as us. It's like exact same size. And so we're going to be, in exchange for taking some of their programming or bits, having access to their programming, we'll be giving them local news and other items. And we're doing the same thing with another station that's up in the Catskills out of our range that just started up a couple weeks ago. And it's much more in the town of Rock Springs. It's very kind of hemmed-in community. They're dealing with two townships, and it's run in cooperation with the town. But they being in the New York City watershed, there's a different funding basis. So we're doing some programming shares there as well. Going back to the idea of how to work with a specifically kind of rural community, one of the nice things is we're basically dealing with two counties here, it's about maybe 15 or 20 townships, you know, a few villages is one city, and it's all, what's nice is that it's manageable in terms of knowing, you know, we can make a running list of who's who in each town, and people who, have never spoken on the radio, but the nice thing about a rural community is that you can access its heart really easily, and that's one of the things to constantly be aware of. And one of the ways of doing that is, larger staff meetings where everybody just talks about the community, at least on a monthly basis, and if possible on a weekly basis, where you just, you know, you can find out, it's basically like gossiping together to find out, okay, who's got an award, who's, you know, who's got their 50th wedding anniversary coming up, who's, you know, and sometimes a news story comes out of that that you can only cover on a local basis. We had a thing, did you hear about the thing last year where the guy out in Columbia County killed his herd of cows and then committed suicide, and that was something that nobody knew how to handle and stuff. You know, where it's a community station can actually go in there and get the sound of it, get the you know, of you know, in what it means in terms of its repercussions.
What did you guys do to cover that?
We weren't on yet. We basically ran kind of a photo essay thing on the blog at that point.
Okay.
Let me just open it up and just get a sense of where everybody's coming from here.
And what you need from us, if anything.
Idaho, Verde, Idaho.
Okay. You've come a good long way. And are you with a station or starting up a station?
We're trying to start a station.
And
I'm from around here, and I'm just sort of on the support web.
Which county are you?
I'm right here in Hudson.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm from Chicago, and we work, you know, I work with Radios Populares, so we actually do set up some stations in Latin America, and a lot of them have been in remote communities, which is kind of interesting because we're coming as outsiders, as you just like equipment, but it's interesting to compare rural broadcasting here to there. So that's what I'm kind of curious about. But
that's a great project.
Yeah, it's been around, I've been involved for the past 2 or 3 years, but they've started a while ago and worked in Honduras, Nicaragua, Bolivia, pretty much those three. It's usually with communities that are connected to solidarity communities in Chicago. So
okay.
A lot of the stuff comes from that connection and those just kind of like pass the hat fundraising. So
that's exciting.
I live in Montreal. I'm from a small community in southeastern British Columbia. I went to journalism school in Montreal and kind of ended up there. And it's been interesting, like, just how urban-centric coverage in Canada is. And it's interesting, too, like, bringing up the internet and cell phones a lot. The community I'm from is one of the bigger towns in the area. It's 10,000 people. And we only got high-speed internet in probably 2003 or so, and a lot of the communities around there don't have much in the way of internet or...
It's probably really expensive, too.
It's on par with whatever you're paying, but it's harder to get it. And if people don't have it or they're not used to having it, they also don't use it or know how to use it or bother using it or bother investing in a computer that will actually run the internet or whatnot. So I think that's also a problem with the way media is going for rural communities. A lot of the areas also don't have cell phone coverage at all. So
it's
that's also quite controversial when they try to bring cell phone coverage in. People don't want cell phone coverage. So.
We've got that. The nice thing there, I've dealt with a lot of communities that, you know, at the point when cable comes in and at the point when access comes into some sort, and a lot of our places are battling cell phones. And the nice thing is that the community is in a way much closer knit until that point when they start listening to these national broadcasts that take their mind off of what's going on locally. And I look at it more as one of the opportunities of rural coverage rather than a challenge a lot of times.
Yeah, and they'll be, because their options are different, they'll be, not to say that there's any kind of backwardness other than this, but they'll be sort of how, you know, in the state that a community like this was in 15 years ago, where there's not the expectation of on-demand.
So, you know, there is real opportunity for terrestrial radio to have a meaning because it's a way of spreading information. So, I mean, the CBC used to, I don't know if they do this anymore, but have people posted all over the place, you know, in the territories, and do they not do that anymore?
They've cut back a fair bit in the past few years on, like, the smaller bureaus. They do have, like, one-man bureaus throughout different regions.
Oh, they do. Okay, they
do,
still
but
do that.
It's definitely centralized in Toronto, first off, and then in whatever biggest city center in the province.
Yeah, we're starting a new station in Towson, but we've been doing broadcasting for about 7 years through other stations and through the internet.
Oh, okay.
And we're also starting a TV station, which is going to be another challenge. Again, in our case, we have the problem of the distance between all these different communities and then the tricultural complications, or it's more than tricultural. Each pueblo is like a completely different community that's very, very, you know, self-contained, and to cover, for example, what's happening at Pickery's Pueblo beats us, like, really, really difficult, you know, to get into that community and report on it. And so you have all these strong divisions, I mean, much more than here. I mean, they're physical divisions and they're cultural divisions.
There's probably miles between each place.
Right, and then, like I say, within any particular Pueblo, there's all these different factions, and it's just very difficult to really penetrate that and get it covered. So it's definitely going to be a challenge to have real coverage of those.
So for you guys, maybe there's an issue, you know, disregarding some of what I said before, of just simply, there will be great power in giving these communities their time
yeah.
on the clock. And because you're, in a sense, you're just sort of figuring out how you can make a collective community out of all these little communities. And so maybe the issue won't be so much, you know, this whole sustaining a narrative kind of thing on the air. Though I bet as you move forward, there will be ways when you say, oh, you know, you guys have been talking about this environmental issue, and so have you, and let's do, you know, let's work together to do an hour where maybe there's somebody in the studio and they're calling into this place, and there's like a conference on the air, just something more lively that brings people together eventually. But it sounds like you will really need people to feel ownership, which
yeah.
is really important.
You have to have a lot of patience. I mean, like even the coverage that we've done of Taos Pueblo, it took calls for like 2 years before anyone would even come forward. You know?
Wow.
I mean, you have to be really, really patient. You have to build up the trust. You can't expect that, like, you call and then they're supposed to just, like, instantly think that you can talk to them. I mean, it's just unrealistic. And mm-hmm. you have to be totally non-judgmental about that. You just say, I'm going to keep calling. And again, if we get them on the air and they have their ownership, then they're going to share what they want to share to the larger community. I mean, again, it's a matter of respecting people's right to decide what they want to put out. Certain things are private that stay within the public community. Other things they want to share and get out, and that's their decision, not necessarily your decision. You know?
Yeah, but I think it is good to think that eventually, as
yeah.
part of your future, that there will be
yeah.
collective decisions. But I think you're right, and I think maybe it'll be different once you are on the air.
And I think it's once you get the kids involved. In other words, we found that.
Yeah, kids.
Junior, senior high school students and first year community college students are just fantastic. And I think once they get involved, they're going to have a different point of view than their parents in terms of what gets shared. And so it will develop over time that people see this as a resource that they can use to discuss issues that their elders might not want to discuss.
Have you managed to engage any of the community elders?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, and again, it's covering things like there's like a Living Treasures program. So you know, every year we bring on seven Living Treasures that are honored in their 80s, and they talk about what they've done. And I mean, you look for every opportunity where you can take some kind of community event and bring those people in. And once you've done that, then they trust you. You know, the next time you call them about a news event, they're going to talk to you because they were on the air themselves. And you were honoring them, you know. So it's just a matter of.
Are you doing non-broadcast events as well? Or?
Yeah, we do a lot of recording of meetings and put the whole meeting on. I mean, just 3 hours of a land grant meeting or something, then there's no way you'd ever get that, you know, on the air, ever.
But you put it up on the web, is what you're saying, okay.
And people listen to it, very definitely.
Yeah, we found, we also, I mean, with the, both the Phoenicia paper, but also when we were setting up a, I was involved in setting up a radio station up in southeast Alaska years ago, in which we were dealing with it's a similar sort of dispersed mixed community. And we did a lot of, you know, both these places, we were doing a lot of square dances and movie presentations that weren't documentaries, that were more fun kind of events that got everybody out together and trusting of each other.
Yeah, we cover a lot of cultural events. I mean, there's a whole writers series that they do every week, a different writer reading, and we do that, or musical events. You know. And again, it seems to me that if you want to reach your community, you may have a point of view you're trying to get across, some kind of political point of view, but if you don't cover all these different things, you're just going to be talking to yourself, basically. Yeah. So you have to cover a lot of things so that a lot of people will be listening. Otherwise, there's no point in it, basically.
I'm from Williamsport, Pennsylvania. I said before, we're trying to start our own radio station. We have an alternative newspaper. We are competing with the local newspaper, which is majorly Republican and head up butt, and there's also a one that gets mailed to, there's 30-some thousand people in our community, and we're the county seat of about 100,000, and maybe 25,000 people get this paper every week called the Web Weekly, which the guy is just a complete crazy person who writes these unbelievable, like, tea bagger type editorials and so on. And so I think our needs are slightly different, because we do want to be the sort of not too far left all the time, but we need to be that other voice that is never heard in our community at all. Besides, the musicians want to get the music that no one hears out and all that, and we want to do the local YMCA and the gospel church and all these other things, but we do need the left, and we want to have politicians on that can address, so people can actually hear, you know, both sides and what's really going on. But I think, I in particular am involved because we need to address the hydrofracking and all these other things. The newspaper is going to just put the actual news stories in.
The web thing you mentioned, I'm starting to suspect, look into the funding of those. Those are popping up all across the country right now. And I suspect there's some
external
funding on there. It was a proposal. I was talking years ago with it, because we do a free newspaper, and we had been talking to Soros people and Move On people about doing it almost as a Democratic Party way of countering what was going on by instilling these small little newspapers around. Of course, they went with large advertising.
Well,
et cetera, but I think what's happened is that I suspect that the Tea Party has picked this up, because there are a lot of them going on.
This one's been around for years, and it's this big, and it has a huge amount of advertising. I mean, and people think this is, all the people that move in and everything
think
and
real.
It's so hard to get rid of it. We live out in the country, and we had to do an obscenity thing. We had to call it obscene to get it stopped being delivered, because asking them six times didn't work, and we won our case, but I'm actually going to write an article to tell other people how to get rid of it.
Yeah. Do you use a lot of humor in the paper and et cetera? That's one great way of winning people.
Yeah, well, we were actually going to do the response. We were going to actually do responses to the editorial and do it in a humorous way, you know, as a column, like an ongoing column. But we only come out every other month at this point.
The worst of these situations, down in Cold Spring, New York, down in Putnam County down here, Roger Ailes bought the local newspaper and started sprinkling Ayn Rand quotes, et cetera, all throughout the thing, changed the focus. And this is in a community that's moved very much to the left in recent years. And so they were struggling. I went down trying to help them start a newspaper, and they finally came up with a web presence. And then at the same time, just started just barreling letters into the Ailes paper. And at first, he was phoning up every letter writers, you know, arguing with them, and then he found he didn't have time to keep up with them. So.
No.
Thank you.
Marielle?
What do I have to say?
Oh,
when you were here.
Why you're here.
Why I'm here.
Where you're from.
Well,
I'm originally from Argentina, but I live here in Kingston, New York, which is half hour south from here. I'm going to have a radio show in this radio sometime. It's going to be in Spanish. The name is Que Cocinare Hoy, which means what's cooking. Oh, that's how I want to translate it. So it's not about food necessarily, but news and commentary and humor. And I run a publication in Spanish called La Voz that is for Ulster, Dutchess, and Orange counties, which are three counties in this area. It's sponsored by Bard College, so it's kind of independent. I don't have anyone telling me what to do, but I have a sponsor, which is perfect. Sometimes I have to write grants to get more funding. So I have a lot of students writing for La Voz that are students from Bard, students from other local colleges or high schools, even people from the communities. Most of the writers are volunteers. I left copies of La Voz up front. And I can show you so you can see what I'm talking about. I only have three here, but this is La Voz.
Oh, great.
And you can find it. What else?
And are you dealing with rural issues as well?
Well, actually, the magazine we distribute in Dutchess, Ulster, and Orange, and there are parts in particularly Northeast Dutchess County, like in Millerton, Milton, Caminha, Pine Place, that's very rural, and it's difficult for us to reach our readers. So we leave copies like in laundromats, or churches, or like social services agencies. You know, people start taking them and they pass them around. This is like in that part is the only publication in Spanish, or there is the only thing that you can find in Spanish that is not the TV. People get this information. La Voz tries to help with like navigating the system. So if there's information about legal rights, education, English learning, health, and then there's literature and, you know, a little more on other topics that are not so daily based. I don't know, I think the most important, like the problem for people in those areas is the lack of transportation. So, and the language barrier as well. There are not enough people who are bilingual.
We should talk because I teach at New Paltz, and you know, some of my journalism students are bilingual and could be great volunteers.
Okay,
I definitely would like to get your contact information.
Can I pass a little announcement?
Sure.
If you speak Spanish today at 4 p.m., I'm going to give a little workshop about what is news and how to write news in Spanish.
I'm Brooke from Saraceno, and I work for WBTN, which is in Bennington, Vermont. And my project that I'm working on is to start a community journalism program where we train community members to write and record their own news stories. And the community is kind of hungry for local and rural news that's relevant to them.
So. Do you have a print media around there as well that's covering local, or has that died out? So?
There is a small local newspaper called the Bennington Banner. But the quality of the journalism.
Where you are over there, are you going to cross do you cross the border? Because I know you're right in that little corner.
Yeah, we reach, you know, parts of New York and Massachusetts as well. So, yeah, the Community Journalism Project is open to anyone in that general Bennington area. Yeah.
And my name is Hannah Miller. I am also from Pennsylvania, and I'm also working very hard on passing the moratorium on fracking in Pennsylvania. I work for an organization called Penn Action, and we do organizing statewide, and in a lot of the rural parts of Pennsylvania right now, there's just a tremendous lack of connection, information, resources, help on what's going on, because there's just not enough, there's not enough education about what's some of the stuff that's happening. And because fracking is, for those of you who don't live in this area, like it's a really, really horrible, very toxic environmental form of oil and gas or gas drilling that's kind of coming into the Northeast really, really quickly. So it's already here and it's just going to get worse. And but so I came here today just to find out if there's a way to try to if radio can help in sort of in just getting it basic, the most basic information on like how not to have your house, you know, your water ruined out to in some of the counties in PA.
Just a suggestion on that. One of the things that was uncovered by the whole fracking issue is the economic underpinnings of the whole thing, where they're able to attract support by people who think that they can sell a right that's not going to affect them in any way. And one of the reasons I found that came in was utilized so well is that there used to be a whole mechanism of rural development agencies that were working with everything from housing situations to grants and you know there was a whole slew of Main Street loans that would come through and help communities, and all of that has dried up, or the organizations themselves ended up being co-opted over the last 10 or 15 years. And it might be interesting to simply focus on instead of focusing on the issue, sometimes focusing on the alternative to the issue.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think we should open it up to see what everyone here could need or use?
Although before we do that, I wanted to ask
what about resources? I mean, how much resources can you devote to news in your station? I found that seems to be a big problem with stations in our area. They just won't put any money into the news departments. I mean, they just won't. Yeah. To me, it's just crazy that they don't consider it important enough to put substantial resources in there.
But are you talking, who are you talking about?
Well, I mean, like KUNM in Albuquerque, KSFR in Santa Fe, the station in Alamosa, which reaches us, you know, for 2 years, they didn't even have a news department. They just, someone quit. Oh, we can save $30,000. No news. It's just like, there doesn't seem to be in public radio, in lots of cases, the appreciation of the fact you've got to spend money to have people do the work, you know, and how do you get the money and how do you convince the station staff to make that priority?
That's a really important question. I think there are two reasons for this right now, this trend. One is some of the changes in broadcasting regulation under the Clinton administration that ended the fairness doctrine, essentially, which in some stations has, and also the public affairs requirements. Stations used to have to, both commercial and public, do a certain amount of public affairs programming, usually an hour a week, which is not very much. But that's gone now. So I think that has had an impact. Obviously, the economy, there's an expense to it. There's also the issue of stations really doing some soul searching, if that's probably too glorified a term, about what's going to make them competitive. And to me, public radio, because it's public, for whatever that's worth, it really has a moral obligation, because as I said, anybody can listen to Bach now any way they want, or Beethoven or what have you, which used to be what public radio stations spent most of their airtime on. But not anybody can get a really good investigative report on fracking or some other, you know, Native American affairs or some other issue in their area. And also public radio is, I mean, it's being seen, and this is interesting in light of the developments here, as a real opportunity because it has a blend of funding sources, which is making it theoretically more stable than the newspaper industry, for example. However, I think that has functioned more successfully in some areas, such as NPR and some of the stronger local or city-based stations, than in others. And others have just felt like, okay, our underwriting's down, we have no money, somebody left, goodbye, we're saving $30,000. So I think there are resources, but they also need to know that this really matters. You know, and that level of pressure
can be difficult. You know, you can do on a personal level, do things like ask to meet, ask to, you know, write letters, say we need this to happen. Try to get on the board of those stations. I think that would be powerful because they're usually looking for board members.
Well, we're starting the new station because we're sort of giving up
because
on them.
In part is, and that could end up changing things. But also, I think there have been very successful collaborations between public radio stations and universities, uh-huh. training journalists. So if there are any connections you can make there, if there is a journalism program in your area that isn't already entwined with a particular station or a newspaper, that could be a really excellent resource. So, I mean, you're doing the right thing. You're competing, and you're going to show why it's, I mean, not competing. I don't want to make that in like a numbers kind of
issue. No, you're putting out
something
that's not there.
You're putting out something and saying this is valuable, and that's huge. And you can use it to your advantage in grant writing, you know, in getting community support. It's not going to be easy, but as far as why stations aren't putting the money into it, it's an issue of the economy, but it's also an issue of somehow they're getting this signal that it's not valuable.
I think it's
and
also
and that's a big problem.
They've gotten so hooked into a kind of professionalization of sound, whatever, that, you know, I mean, everybody's, you know, you're comparing it to All Things Considered, which is a fine show.
Considered, yeah.
But it takes the focus off of what is local, and the same with television news or whatever, that you can't just rely on this professional voice, that it's going to be messier. But, you know, so, you know, the way I've worked in with really low budgets in a media, print media area, where, you know, I do a hell of a lot more work to make it work in the center, but it's finding a lot of different voices that come in. You can sprinkle a little bit of money a long way that way, or none at all. You can work with, I mean, but you have to be careful that you're not just working with passion, because the passion can get corrosive at some time. You want to tamp it down to a certain extent so that you get this nice evenness that allows your listeners to come in. And then once you start to involve the listeners too, you have a great resource that you can pull through there, so that it then just becomes a question of you know, mixing assignments and editing down what is coming in. And, you know, one of the things that I've been battling with for years up here, and it's actually started to break through, there was a long time where everybody was going after the same story. You know, everybody wanted to have their own take on the same, you know, original journalism. Screw that, is my sense, is that it's not, what's important is getting the news out. It's not as important the take on it. It's getting all these pieces together and creating a whole out of them. And that's where I think the whole idea of well-done news blogs, it's all out there, and you can pull it and just put it into a context that then reflects your community.
Well, I'm glad you made that point about the quality issue, because, I mean, we have this incredible agriculturalist that produced 36 half-hour programs on agriculture and the acequias, and a couple of them played on, we were able to get UNM to play a couple of them, and they stopped doing it, and then we asked them afterwards, it's like, and Jim Williams, who's the news director, they're good journalists, he said, well, it just wasn't NPR quality. And it was like, wait a second. I mean, they never told us what was wrong with it. I didn't, you know, I think it was, again, it wasn't this very, like, just perfect audio, perfect. To me, the content is far more important than the audio quality. I mean, that you have really informative content. And as people do, I think once you get people doing the content, they're going to get better at the audio. Yeah. You know, that's going to happen just naturally.
But that's precisely the difference between community radio and public radio.
Yeah,
I mean, public radio, basically, they're striving to have high professional standards. I think in your situation, you have this real catch-22 where they're not putting their resources into the news and the professionalism, and they're refusing to air other things. You know, they're sort of just shutting down news because it can't be perfect.
I mean, they actually wanted to work with this guy, Miguel Santisteban, but their whole idea was that he would make all the contacts,
he would develop the story, and then Jim Williams would come in and do the interview, and Jim Williams would edit it. And it was like they wanted to take his voice out of it, you know. And it just
this
was,
is
I mean,
going on in all media or, right now. This is the idea behind the Sundance Institute, all these things that you take what is an independent voice and you make it more palatable to a larger entity. And it just, what's really going on now is that our tools don't need to do that anymore. And it's a process of teaching your audience not to have to expect this other thing that's built basically to sell advertising. And it's starting to happen with the amount of people passing on information through YouTube, the way that social media is working. It's going much more low tech,
yeah.
and it's happening, whether the media outlets know it or, you know, the larger media outlets are following it or not. So, you know, I say to just write it, and the nice thing is that if you're, especially in a rural community, they will go along with you if you're offering something that they can't get anywhere else, and it's very valuable because their community doesn't hold together without it.
Well, it's kind of neat. Zach Rosen has this new program called State of the Reunion. He won this contest to get this interview program on. It's like every month they feature a different city, and they just featured Española, and they somehow found us and contacted us, and we put them in contact with all these different individuals, including Miguel. And they actually did, they used it the way they should have. I mean, it's a pretty well-done piece that lets most of the people talk in their own voice, and that got broadcast nationally.
How has it worked working in the communities that you've been going into and setting up?
In terms of professionalism and that?
I'm just intrigued in the whole, is all the community welcoming, or what are the challenges that you're facing when you come into a community from the outside?
It's been very, since it's kind of based on a solidarity model with an organization in the community, it's not like just this is a community radio. The radio station in Nicaragua was working with a women's health organization. So basically their impetus was, we want to get information. It was a rural community. So we built a really large tower, and it was so flat, so the signal went really far, which was very beneficial. And just information about health, how women can come, when are the times for blood testing, stuff like that. And then that kind of grew into something larger. So from that, then people said, oh, I can have a radio station or a program about this to broadcast to the community. And like Lisa was saying about a mission, I think if they would look at their mission, if it fell in line with the mission, then they would kind of try to incorporate those other community members. And then when the project I worked on in Bolivia was actually an urban area outside of La Paz, and it was very populated. And it was started from a youth theater collective. So it was based on kind of youth issues, and they did radio drama. So it was more artistic in the way it started. And the community, there's like thousands of huge radio towers that there's a lot of interference. So the signal wasn't as important, I think, as the educational aspect of that station. So it kind of all depends. I mean, we can't say there's one model that we like go into and, you know, this is what you guys should do. Because it's mostly like we're bringing equipment.
So you're coming in kind of answering one call and then letting it open up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we work a lot with the communities beforehand to make sure, you know, they are not going to use this radio for something that's, you know, it's not like we just like get a phone call, hey, we're on a radio station, we're like run to the scene, you know. It's like there's a lot of solidarity with groups in Chicago, and they say, you know, there's this organization in Honduras that's fighting for land takeovers and stuff and land rights, so they have a radio station. And I was going to say they've had a lot of threats to the radio station lately, and they recently had a delegation go down. I did not go down with them, but they brought a mobile unit, so like a transmitter that fits in like a backpack, which is really cool. And they've been going around to different communities, partly to keep the radio station moving, so there's not like one main place, but partly to kind of show people that like from this point we are broadcasting, and so people
really understand.
I don't know if these pueblos are very far away, but like the presence of a radio station, like, you know, just one day a week maybe in their village could be something kind of powerful, like, oh, okay, so everybody in the village is getting the strongest signal today, you know, and we're doing a program.
We couldn't do that with SCZ, but you certainly could have a lot of broadcast.
That's the...
Bounce to the transmitted community.
Yeah, that has a huge effect, and just, yeah, doing presence within communities.
Yeah, physical presence, because...
Is the tower in any danger, or is it come under any threat, or...
In the city, it was...
A little harder, because the one threat would be that there's interference with other big stations than the Bolivian FCC or something is aware. I think in Nicaragua, in the rural areas, it was way off the radar. If they got more power, which they obviously will want to do later, you know, maybe get higher power, then it would be more threat and more, yeah. But that's kind of the risk they undertake, and, you know, we say...
We have a woman staying with us as part of all this who's doing... She's now doing this in African nations, but she's in the Balkan nations, where I guess a lot of money in every embassy was setting up stations, it was pure Balkanization, and they had to then retract everything. They took away all the licenses and started again. The Americans were pushing for a privately funded sector that was more locally news based, whereas, you know, the European model was always sort of more public, national sort of base, and they came in such clash that they're now kind of retrenching and building.
I was shocked. I was talking to a lawyer from India. There's apparently no public radio at all or community radio in India. I mean, it's completely prohibited by the government. They want complete control of it. Yeah.
I think that's
why,
I think the model in the United States is very unique, because the community radios kind of seem to start
separate
out of this,
from the government, yeah.
Yeah, or this idea that, you know, news needs to get to the community, versus like radio in Latin America might be more of, it's more common. I think radio is like more powerful or more effective. Not effective, that, I don't know.
Well, people can't really afford to buy newspapers and get the newspapers out to the little villages, so the radio reaches them where... There's no other medium, basically. Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe it's more used, there's just more stations that have this interest, this group, this target. But that's kind of the perspective I was really intrigued by, is like a community, a rural community, which I'm not very familiar with, and the kind of how much compromise is involved in creating a balanced and just comprehensive.
Just from my perspective in print media, it's a constant compromise to a certain extent, but then you find areas that you can, little things that nobody would pay attention. I do a municipal I Ching, which I just make up, and people don't know what to make of it, but it pulls the paper in a certain direction. Then I use another. Just a section from, I call POV, where I pull something from the greater literature that, a few weeks ago when all the battling was going on about, you know, the mosque, etc., something from Vivekananda's 1893 address to the Congress of Religions, and it just completely countered the thing, and it just is a quiet little piece that then floats through everything else, and you know, it's sort of like Roger Ailes throwing Ayn Rand through his papers. You can counter it in a different fashion. In the Bennington area, with your community, are you reaching out to the municipal governments as well, or working around them at this point?
It's a brand new project. It just started about a month. Those we're still kind of designing it, but the community journalism project specifically will function as a news blog on air broadcast and as a podcast. So what was your question about? Was it about the community journalism?
Or who you're reaching out to
as community.
Anyone
and everyone. I mean, we're trying to make it as broad as possible. We will open doors to you know, government officials, like the town public offices, to tell their stories, but then community members and school kids. We're trying to work with the colleges in the area too. Some of them have partnerships with like low-income housing children. So we're very underfunded. So we're trying to use institutions in the community that have funding to kind of, like Bennington College, for instance, get their recording equipment and computers available to like the low-income housing children. So it's very broad at this point, and we want people to use it as a way to speak.
Just a couple of tips, since there are people in this startup situation. Are you aware of the Knight Foundation and the grants that they have?
Yeah.
Are you also aware of Youth Radio? The Youth Radio Project?
A little bit, but I don't know much.
In Berkeley, yeah,
It's based, I think it started out there, but I mean, I think they have one in Chicago. And
they're all over.
They're all over. And I think that those templates can be good, because when you see that, you know, the Chicago Bureau is doing this and they're using this kind of grant, you might be able to just follow in their path when they do this sort of training. I think projects that are educational are always, the potential for it to be grant friendly is greater when you say, I'm getting kids involved, I'm, you know, I'm being productive. Radio Diaries has done a lot of work with teenagers and, you know, getting them equipment and having them record the sounds of their lives and getting narrative out of it, really amazingly powerful narrative out of that. So I think the more, you know, that just gives you a little bit, as you're seeking a path and seeking to get this solid and established, that those resources could be really, really great.
Oh, just a painless, expenseless way of really establishing, I've always found, is to set up meet the candidates events. A lot of rural communities have never had a meet the candidate event of any sort, and either work with the you know, if there isn't a League of Women Voters, set it up. My wife now runs it. Work by their rules and regulations are really standard. They'll call. I mean.
Yeah, they do great.
The first few times, we've always had it where the, half the time the Republican Party will not come out, but then they look pretty bad. And eventually, by the second or third time you're doing it, they will come out. And it also forces your local papers to pay attention. It forces the those in power, because you have to remember that the electoral system, especially as you go, the more rural you go, the more it actually does reflect those communities. And you can't turn your back on that, but also the more responsive they will be to anything coming up, and the more they'll want to engage you as well as you engage them. But, the Meet the Candidates forums are just a great way of getting everybody on the same platter, and using your radio, whether you're broadcasting live yet or just web streaming or doing it by word of mouth, it changes the nature of the game and has a huge effect. And the more sort of those community, I had another paper with the regional paper that I had. I started doing monthly roundtables that would be open to anybody to come, and it got to be, there'd be 200 people, and all we'd have time for is everybody to introduce themselves around the table, and that would be it. But it didn't matter. That process had a huge effect of building up consortiums and also putting us in the position, a central position within the community. And these are things that, you're in a rural place where people do like to meet together. funny thing, one of the first meetings I ever went to was in a really small town up in the mountains, and everybody fell asleep in the meeting.
That's so funny. That's great.
It was one of
those. So they want to get together, but they want to
take a nap.
Yeah, they were comfortable with each other. It's really hot. They ate, drank hot chocolate, ate cookies, and one by one, knocked out.
On the other side of the sugar hot. Awesome.
Yeah. What time do we run to?
11.
So,
anything else?
I'm really interested in you guys with the Idaho. Is it a very rural community?
Well, it's kind of a small town, you know, and they only have one radio. But a lot of people's complaining about the radio because when they trying to do like promotion or something like that, or anything, you know, sometimes not even listen to the people, you know. And I guess people needed somebody to listen, you know, to give it a chance to speak or do whatever they need, you know. And that's why we trying to do a new radio station. Then we don't know nothing about it, you know. So we just came right now.
How large is the community that you're trying to reach?
Our towns are like 30 miles apart, so there's agriculture community, and so there's a town here, 30 miles, there's another town, so there's a 60 miles, there's another town, so it's not, it's a big town, but it's just to spread out, and what we're trying to do is just learn. The station that he's talking about is a commercial station. Well, as you know, that's only to make money, you know. They don't really care about the feelings of the other people, just to make money. So it's really interesting on this one because I can see a lot of potential where people is lost everywhere. So this be a voice for all them people right there. And so we're here to learn. So that's all we do.
Great. And you came in late. What's your, are you coming out of a rural area?
Well, Catskill, if that's rural.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I actually went to the wrong workshop and then I got involved with it, so I've been to three workshops so far, but I did mean to get to this one earlier, as I know I've missed most of it. No, I'm just doing presenting a program on community radio here. And I'm a journalist, so
okay.
Wanted to take in a bit about news gathering in rural communities, but I've missed it all, so.
Oh, actually, we didn't even touch, I mean, just we were going to talk about that, one of the the keys to gathering news rurally is you're going to talk about keeping a Rolodex, but at the same time, everybody doesn't change that much in the phone book's much smaller.
I worked in Iowa, and you know, if I needed to reach someone, I used the phone book. And if it was like a fairly common last name like Rogers, I would just call one of them, and he would usually be related to the other. He'd be like, do you know? And he'd be like, oh yeah, he's my cousin. Here's his number. It was great. But yeah, I mean, Rolodex is.
But just calling,
I guess, you know, I think
just that, keeping in contact.
Yeah, people, keeping. Yeah. I did mention that about having your. Forming community partners if you're covering a rural area so they can keep
what's
you
happening?
In touch with the developments and you can make connection. I think really the thing that I would want to say, you know, I feel like there's been two themes to this conversation and they actually reflect, you know, a debate in journalism and in our online culture, which is, you know, the power of amateurism versus, I mean, what I would see as the potential perils of it. So meaning amateurism, meaning you've got community radio, you're out there covering communities, you're putting stuff up, you're getting voices on the air, and it's all in a, you know, basically an amateur way, and that's not to degrade it, but to just say it, like that's what community radio is. But then I think that ultimately, I just would want to encourage all of you to, as your resources grow,
not to fear professionalism, because that is something, you know, the standards of journalism, the practice of good journalism, is at great peril in our democracy, and that if you are able to form within your core of volunteers, if you start to have a professional staff within that, a group that is truly taking on journalism, you know, with high standards, with an enterprising spirit, you're covering the stories the other stations aren't covering, you are doing something really mighty. You know, so along with diversity of voices, opinion, all that stuff, I think that should be part of your ultimate goal. I feel very strongly about that, in fact, because it's so in danger in our democracy.
Well, that's
right,
yeah,
now.
That's one of the reasons we're starting the station, so we'll have the resources to do that.
Yeah.
Right now, we don't have the research. We see a really tough issue, and we know we don't have, you know, we'll get sued if we just jump in without doing the in-depth investigation to really expose that. So
I mean, the one thing, it's never bad just to bringing up the issue is fine. You don't need an opinion on it. You don't need, it doesn't have to be a complete report. Just bringing it up and knowing to step back as soon as it feels like you're stepping into an area you don't quite know, you can acknowledge it and step back. And the nice thing in the more rural and community-based your news gathering is, the more you're going to return to subjects, because the subjects don't change that much.
But what I'm also saying, I'm kind of, I don't think I'm parting ways with you exactly.
Yeah.
I'm saying you need, in the first sustainable future, you need both. You need a space for, okay, let's, and you know, and I think that's an amazing thing about community radio, that
you can do both.
You can do both, you know, and that you ultimately can do both. The station I came from, at least at the time I was doing both. People were getting reports aired on Pacifica nationally. You know, whether you want to go in that direction is totally optional. I think that if you've got a good station and you're doing powerful journalism that's telling the undertold stories, that whatever you can do to work toward that goal, making alliances with professional association, having mentors, you know, tapping into your university. I mean, I would just, you know, if somebody asked me, you know, if Paul said, I want you to come up and do a workshop on enterprise reporting and how to put it together. Mm-hmm. It would be really, you know, I'd tell everybody it's super hard work and all that stuff, but I think there you will eventually have volunteers with that level of commitment, especially younger people who are, you know, looking into this as a career possibility and so forth. So, I'm sorry, both of you, I'm not sure who raised their hand first, but...
Just to expand on what you are saying, I totally agree with you. And if you are interested, I received an email yesterday from CUNY, University of New York City in journalism, and they are giving workshops that are maybe 1 or 2 weeks, and they are like $39 each.
Wow.
So I think it's very accessible, and they are very great about basic things of journalism, and they want to do this for city journalism. So check out the website.
It's sort of related, but I was going to say, I think the advantage of smaller communities, which is hard in Chicago, but it's possible in a city, is like community workshops where people can see the equipment and then, you know, do their own voicing, and then they hear it and they're like, whoa, you know, that sounds weird, or like, sounds really terrible, who would listen to me talk for a little, you know? But they kind of are, introduce the idea that, you know, it takes a little bit, like amateur radio, people starting, people experimenting, it's going to sound different than NPR and even like the... So when you're listening then to the community station, you're like, okay, I was doing that, you know, that was hard, but it's not, I'm getting kind of a different person speaking at me, you know, so it could be like, it kind of demystifying is like what we talk, when we do stuff in Chicago, it's like, it's not just because people aren't going to get on the air right away, but so people just know that it's not that, like, this elitist type, you know, privilege that people have to talk on the radio.
That's a really important point, because that's the level you're working, you know, when somebody first walks into a radio station, that's their first fear, is being on the air, what am I going to sound like? When I trained my students, they all just recorded little newscasts. They're freaking out about it. I had them stand up in front of the class and give a newscast, the newscast they had written, and they were so uptight about it, but it helped break the ice, because I was showing them, look, you're going to be in the studio alone, but ultimately it's about talking to people.
Yeah.
And that's a really strong message. To say, look, this is just your voice. It'll get better.
or it's just fine the way it is. But in the end, this is about connecting with people. And so, you know, get over your, you know, once you get over this, you have power, you know, to use your voice. So, anyway.
I think we've...
Yeah, we're done.
Our time's done.
I don't want to spill over too much. But thank you so much.
And you, yes, you,